Job chapter 29. Job chapter 29, this begins the first of three chapters of Job's final appeal, but it does come on heels of three previous chapters. Job has been speaking since chapter 26, and as we get into it, it's good to remember how chapter 28 concluded. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn away from evil is understanding. We're going to get some idea of how that worked out in Job's life tonight. Steve, I think we need a little more cool air. Turn it to cool. Turn the heat down to the left. Don't even bother with that. That's dead. The one on the right doesn't even work.
We're working now, though.
Yeah, just need a little cool air. Yeah. All right. We're going to see how verse 28 at the end of chapter 28 worked out in Job's life. What Job does is begin to sum up his case here, very much like a lawyer in this chapter and chapter 30 and 31. And in this chapter, he emotionally recalls his past. The months of old, the days, he said, when God watched over me. And he begins by saying, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, and my children were all around me." We'll pause there for just a minute. I want you to notice, first of all, before we go too far into it, the implied contrasts, the unspoken contrasts. In verse 2, he remembers in the days when God watched over me. What's the contrast? Today, God is not watching over me now. That's the idea. And he says, by his light, I walked through darkness. First of all, what do you suppose that means? Since it's not talking about literal light and darkness. If you talked about yourself, that by his light you walked through darkness, what would you mean? He helped you in time of danger, and obviously that has changed because he is physically ravaged and he despairs of his life. What else might that mean? By his light I walked through darkness. And the implication is, of course, now I don't. What kinds of darkness are there other than danger?
Unbelief.
There's also the darkness of being confused by situations and not knowing how to handle them, not knowing how to proceed. And you get the impression that Job was a very wise man with God's wisdom, and by the power of God, he was able to handle a great deal of difficult situations and perhaps confusing questions. We'll see that kind of reflected later on when he talks about himself as an elder who judged at the city gate. And you can, I think, possibly identify with Job if you'll think back to early days of your conversion. Because in those golden days after you first come to know the Lord, things seem so very clear and you get so much insight from the Lord, and he seems to be protecting you from confusing ways and false ways and so on. And then, as time goes on, you begin to encounter thorny theological questions and difficult situations come up that you have to deal with. And there's no more confusing situation to anyone than, why has it all been taken away from me? Why is this happening to me? What have I done? And when you're like Job and you feel that the answer is nothing, then you are simply at a loss to explain what God is doing and what's going on. There was a time when by his light, Job walked through darkness. But this is a darkness where he doesn't have God's light. That's his problem. Look at what he says about in verse 4. As I was in my prime, the Hebrew there, as it tells you in a footnote in the ESV, is my autumn days. My autumn days. Now, there are two kinds of autumn days, aren't there? Because he means something positive by my autumn days. He doesn't mean the kinds of autumn days when it turns cold and the leaves wither and die and so on. That's not the image. What happens in autumn?
Your children are grown.
That's true. That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Unless you're, you know, on the second time around. That's true. What else happens in autumn? Yeah, you reap the fruit of your labor. It's harvest time, isn't it? It's harvest time. It's the time when the summer sun and the southern breezes and the rains have done their work, and it is a beautiful time of the year. And it's a time, of course, of I think implied in the idea of harvest is the idea of maturity. So there he was in his prime, no longer a young man, but a man powerful in his strength, maturity, and wisdom. And at that time, he says, that was when the friendship of God was upon my tent. Obviously, he no longer is like a man in his prime. He is skin and bones. He scrapes himself with a pot shard. He is miserable constantly, both physically and emotionally. And so his autumn days are very much gone. And he feels that the friendship of God is gone too. The friendship of God was upon my tent. And then verse 5, when the Almighty was yet with me, when the Almighty was yet with me, and when my children were all around me. Well, of course, what has happened to his children? They're all dead. All of his children have died in the disaster at the beginning of the book. And the implication, of course, is that was when the Almighty was yet with me. So the unspoken opposites are the things that Job is feeling. They contrast with his memories back in the days when God watched over him and when the Almighty was yet with him. And of course, what has been being said to him by his comforters is, God is no longer watching over you. the Almighty is no longer with you. He has turned against you because of your sin. Now, what do you wish you could say to somebody like Job? As a matter of fact, you sometimes have opportunities to say what you should say if you ever go to visit a nursing home. Have you ever gone to visit a patient in a nursing home and their children, or perhaps they themselves, have pictures on the bureau and the dresser hanging on the wall, and you look at one of the pictures, and if it's a man you're visiting, there he is in the prime of life. He is, you know, full of vigor and strength. A man in the nursing home in which I once worked was actually able to lift a ton with his back. He was able to get under a wagon load of cotton that weighed a ton and raise that wagon load of cotton. His name was Stout. Stout Jackson. And he was written up in Ripley's Believe It or Not. But when I visited him, he was a very weak old man suffering from dementia. But he had the cartoon of himself in Ripley's Believe It or Not. Or you look at some poor old lady who's ravaged by disease, and you look at the picture of the beautiful woman, and you say, was this you? And it was at one time. And it's very easy for a person to think, back in those glory days of their life, the Lord was with me then. That was when God was with me. That was when God was blessing me. That was when we were making a lot of money. That was when my career had taken off. What do those kinds of people need to hear? You're right. God was with you then. Is that what they need to hear? The Lord is still with you. That's the very meaning of Christmas. God with us, Emmanuel. And He will never leave us or forsake us. And Job doesn't know it. And that's what makes it so poignant. He doesn't know that the Lord is with him. He doesn't know that the Lord is proud of him. The Lord has boasted over him before Satan. He doesn't know how approved he is by God. He thinks that those days are over. And why does he think those days are over? Because the blessings are gone and what seems to belong to a curse has come upon him. And that is certainly a good example of how we are to not judge by our outward senses what's going on in a person's life, isn't it? Because Job does not understand what has gone on in heaven. He thinks that the days of his friendship with God are over, when the friendship of God was upon my tent. And that shows you, by the way, that shows you that he does, in the main, share the same kind of theology with his comforters. That God does generally prosper the righteous. He does generally punish the wicked. But Job has come to see that that's not always the case. He has come to see that profound things go on behind the scenes. And we don't know what God is doing. But anyway, Job looks back to these very wonderful memories, and the loss of God to him is in the same category as the loss of his children. When the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were all around me. And then he mentions something in verse 6 that is biblical hyperbole. When my steps were washed with butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. What in the world does that mean? That's good biblical imagery. For what? Wealth. Plenty cows, plenty olive trees. He had butter and cream. You remember what God told Moses, that he was going to deliver the Israelites and take them to a land flowing with milk and honey. This is biblical imagery for the blessings of agriculture, the blessings associated with wealth in those days. And Job had all the butter and olive oil he could have possibly imagined. And then in verse 7, he says, "When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square." What happened at the gate of the city? Business was conducted. Absolutely right. Y'all think of any biblical examples of business being conducted at the gate of the city? Yes, the story of Ruth, where Boaz goes to the gate of the city, asks the elders to sit down with him. They wait for the kinsman redeemer to come by, and they're going to settle the estate of Naomi. My favorite example of something happening at the gates of the city is when Abraham wants to bury Sarah, and he wants to buy the field of Machpelah from Ephron the Hittite. And Abraham begins to ask, who owns the field and so on, how can I get hold of it? And the solution is that he has to go to a meeting of the elders at the city gate. Genesis 23:10 says, "Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites of all who went in at the gate of the city, 'No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it, in the sight of the sons of my people. I give it to you. Bury your dead.'" The wrongest thing in the world for Abraham to say at that point was, "Well, thanks, and go claim it." That was not what was supposed to be done at that point. Abraham knew the next line. "Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, 'But if you will hear me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there.'" He's saying, "I don't want you to give it to me. I'll give you a price for it." Ephron answered Abraham, "My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver according to the weights current among the merchants. Everybody understood perfectly well what was going on. Abraham bought the field that was given to him. This is an example of what happened at the city of gates. But it wasn't just business. What else happened? Judgments. Judgments of grievances, causes, and cases among the townspeople or the villagers. This is where pronouncements of justice and injustice, guilty and not guilty, were made in the gates of the city. And what Job says here is, "When I went out to the gate of the city, when I prepared my seat in the square, the young men saw me and withdrew, and the aged rose and stood." Now, what's unusual about that? You were supposed to stand up for the aged. The aged did not stand up for you. But the aged even stood up and acknowledged that Job was a wise man and a man worth hearing. The aged rose and stood. It says, here, speaking of the deference that was shown to Job, that the young men withdrew. It says in verse 9, the princes, the very important people, refrained from talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The voice of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. It was customary to remain silent until the most honored person had spoken. So what Job is telling us here is that he was extremely highly regarded in his community. he was, as a matter of fact, a very unusual person. You can tell it in verse 11. It says, when the ear heard, it called me blessed. And when the eye saw, it approved. So when the ear heard what Job had to say, it called Job blessed. And when the eye saw Job's manner and attitude, it approved. Job is a very unusual character here, especially in the Bible. He is a beloved rich man. The rich are so often presented as wicked, but Job was not. He was highly regarded and highly appreciated. And why was that? Why did the ear hear him and bless what he said, and the eye see his manner and approve? Well, verse 12 gives the answer. Because I delivered the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to help him. The blessing of him who was about to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. What Job is saying here is that people approved his judgments not because he was rich, not because he was powerful, but because he was full of compassion. He was very concerned about being of benefit socially in the community. And here are two passages I want you to see from his counselor Eliphaz. Turn back with me to chapter 4, to the place where Eliphaz the Temanite answered him. When Eliphaz, who was the first counselor to venture a word with him, spoke to him, he reminded him of the good he had done. Verse 3, behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. In other words, he knew about Job's reputation, and that's how he started with Job. And then, of course, he went on to say, now trouble has come to you, and you're impatient. You need to put yourself in the shoes of the people that you have helped. And that was the way Eliphaz began. But when it came time for Eliphaz to speak the last time to Job, look at Job 22, verse 6. This shows you how arguments and disagreements and conflicts can begin to develop a life of their own and increase beyond not only reason but truth. Look at chapter 22, verse 6. This same Eliphaz is willing to say to him, for you have exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. You've given no water to the weary to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land, and the favored man lived in it. That's you, Job. You have sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. These are scurrilous lies about Job. Job was the opposite of that. And Eliphaz knew it at one time. Eliphaz says, I delivered the poor who cried for help. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. Here's what he did. In verse 14, he said, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. What do you think that verse means? I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. There is a there's a movement in England to try to move away from those curled up horsehair wigs that lawyers and judges wear in England that you see in the mystery movies when a defendant is tried, the idea being that, you know, they're hot, they belong to an antiquated age, we should all be less formal now and just simply dress in business suits, and for lady lawyers who also have to wear those wigs, just nice women's suits and so on. But there is something about putting on the wig and putting on the cloak that's probably beneficial. What is it? It's the idea of authority. It's the idea that you're there to represent something. You're there to stand for something. You're not just there to be yourself only. You are there to pursue what is just, hopefully. Well, what Job, I think, is saying here is, when I stood up in the gates, when it was time for me to speak, I weighed what was right. I weighed what was wrong. I wanted to be just to the situation. And I think that's what he means by, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. In the great old movie Becket, King Henry II appoints Thomas Becket, his best friend, to be Archbishop of Canterbury, figuring that he will always side with his old friend, Henry II. But when he makes him Archbishop of Canterbury, all of a sudden he realizes his huge responsibilities. And so he becomes the Archbishop of Canterbury, and eventually Henry II has to say, will no one rid me of this pestilent priest? And some murderers took it upon themselves to go to Canterbury Cathedral and kill him. Why? Well, because he took his role seriously. He was doing as Job did here, putting on righteousness, putting on justice, as if they were clothing. Now, the great thing about this is that it's a picture of the Christian's privilege, isn't it? It's a picture of the Christian's status. Job did this when it was time to make decisions and judgments. The great thing in the gospel is that the Christian's privilege is to always be clothed in the righteousness of Christ at all times in God's sight. That's how God regards the Christian. What Job is talking about here is doing his duty, doing what he should be doing with fairness and equity. Then he explains how that worked out, the righteousness and the justice that he put on. It says in verse 15, I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy, and I searched out the cause of him whom I did not know. You see what he's saying there? He championed the poor, the needy, the disadvantaged. Job was not only a worshiper of God, as we learned from the first chapter. He was godly in his compassion and justice, even to the extent of searching out the cause of him whom he did not know. He would actually try to find out what he could about someone whom he heard had been wronged. One of the great characteristics of God is his compassion and mercy. We sing about it when we sing, Hallelujah, praise Jehovah, O my soul. That's based on Psalm 146, which says that God executes justice for the oppressed. He gives food to the hungry. He sets the prisoner free. He opens the eyes of the blind. He lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the sojourners. He upholds the widow and the fatherless. But the way of the wicked he brings to ruin. Job is being godly here. He is doing what Jesus expects us to be doing. Matthew 25 speaks of the judgment seat of Christ in which we will be judged on the basis of how our faith worked out practically and what we did for Jesus' brethren. Because he says, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And you know what the righteous will say. Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink, and a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, you did it to me. And that's what Job has been doing. As a wealthy elder in this village, he has, I'm sure, not only given judgments in the favor of those who are oppressed, but he has done his work of charity in helping those who were needy. Furthermore, he has championed the cause of them in a very direct way. It says in verse 17, I broke the fangs of the unrighteous and made him drop his prey from his teeth. So he has actually come against the enemies of the righteous or the needy with some sort of action, perhaps legal action or punitive action, that he has decreed in the city gate. Now, in view of all this, which is service, and this is what Job considers to be the highlight of his life, service to others, here's what he thought would happen. Verse 18. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. I shall die in my nest. That's the Hebrew word there, nest. What does that mean?
Comfort and protection.
The comfort and protection of one's home. The comfort and protection of one's own family. It not only means the home, but it would mean surrounded by others as well. I shall die in my nest. This is one of the great privileges that few of us have. I shall die in my nest. I shall multiply my days as the sand. At the time of the flood, when God brought judgment on the earth, he decreed that the patriarchs should no longer live the fantastic numbers of years, the hundreds of years. You remember the length of time that he shortened the life? It's 120 years. 120 years. But that's what Job was expecting to live out. He was expecting to multiply his days as the sand. And he was expecting, he says in verse 19, that my roots would spread out to the waters with the dew all night on my branches. What's he comparing himself there to? A tree, you bet. And it's easy to think of a passage that casts light on that, isn't it? Psalm 1, he is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not prosper. In all that he does, he does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. So he compares himself to that biblical picture of the man who has put down roots and is sturdy, steady, and as unmovable as a great tree, with the dew all night on his branches. And he says in verse 30, my glory fresh with me. This is a reference to his prowess as a warrior and a hunter, that he would still maintain his physical ability, and my bow ever new in my hand. He would always be ready to shoot an arrow with that bow as his days end. That's what he expected. And this, of course, is a very sad thing when we don't get what we expected to be the case in our old age. And we die what the world would call prematurely, or we die alone, or we die after our other family members have passed away. Things, of course, do change in the outworkings of God's providence, and this is what makes Job's chapter here so poignant. He looks back to these days when he was of service to the community, when he was of help to the needy, and he now sees himself as broken and battered, as afflicted and useless, and nothing has turned out like he planned. Then he goes back to the theme of his honor, and that's very important because in chapter 30 he's going to immediately contrast the derision and the ridicule that he receives now with the honor that he once had. He says in verse 21, "Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After I spoke, they did not speak again, and my word dropped upon them." In other words, the right thing had been said. All that needed to be said had been said. The advice was right. The counsel was valued. Verse 23, "They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouths as for the spring rain." That's a great metaphor in the Middle East, because the spring rain is absolutely essential if the crops are going to survive through the summer. Everyone waits for those early rains, and the counsel of Job was treasured as much as that. "I smiled on them when they had no confidence, and the light of my face they did not cast down." That's an interesting verse, isn't it? His approval encouraged them and won out over their attitude. Have you ever gone to someone with a cheerful countenance and a bunch of encouragement, and after you talk to them for about an hour, you realize they were right and you got as depressed as they were? And their mood affected you, and their whole demeanor turned your joy into mourning when you were off to encourage them. That didn't happen with Job. That did not happen with him. He was able to smile on them, and the light of his face they were not able to cast down. They didn't defeat his cheerfulness and hope. So then here's the apex of the argument. Verse 25. This sums it all up. This was Job's life before his catastrophe. "I chose their way." What does that mean? He was a leader. He led them. "I chose their way and sat as chief." He was the most respected man in the land of Uz. He was the one that they all looked up to. "I sat as chief. I lived like a king among his troops." Here were people who were not only respectful of him, but ready to do his bidding, ready to be instructed as to what to do, and they would do it willingly. And he said, "like one who comforts mourners," because that's what he did some of the time. He actually did comfort mourners and give aid and help and advice to the afflicted. And now, here he is, miserable, with seemingly the curse of God on him. And this is what you will find in the lives of Christians who were once used for God's glory and now are not anymore. They're in nursing homes, or they have gotten old and they can't do the things that they used to. And you'll find, as you talk to such people who have either been disabled through disease or who have been disabled through age, that what is so depressing to them is that they can't be of service. They can't bless other people anymore. They can't be a servant anymore. They can't be used of God anymore. What should we say to them?
They can be a blessing to us, because I know when we have a nursing home ministry, from the end of those people were such a blessing to me.
That's right.
My grandmother always prayed. I mean, even in the nursing home, she was very much of a prayer woman.
That's right. And that's one of the things that we can still do. We can pray, and we can encourage others verbally. What were some of the things that the people in the nursing home did for you?
I remember Miss Candace, she was 102 or 3 years old.
Yeah.
She's always smiling and always talking about the Lord.
Yeah.
She was so happy in the Lord. But after she had her leg amputated and a lot of things, it was harder.
Yes.
Real hard.
Mm-hmm.
But until the very last, she wanted to talk about Jesus.
Yes. Well, you and I are not useless, even when it looks as though that our day may have passed. And this is what Job is particularly longing for. We also have to remember, and again, this is the advice we'd give to Job if we could intervene at this point in the book, God hasn't left you. God hasn't left you. And you may be walking through darkness now and that you're confused about what's going on and everything may have changed. You're no longer in the autumn of your life. It's winter now. But the friendship of God is still with you. You're not perceiving it like you used to. You don't understand it like you once did. But the Almighty is yet with you, Job. And that's one of the great lessons of Jesus' great commission. He gives these impossible commands. Go ye, people just like you and me. Go ye, therefore, into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Make disciples of them and baptize them and teach them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And you would hear that great commission and you would think, yeah, right. That's impossible. That's impossible to go into all the world and change the world. And what does Jesus say? First of all, before he says it, he says, all authority has been given to me in heaven and earth. And you've got to believe that going in. But then he says, lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world. In spite of dungeon, fire, and sword, Jesus is always with his people. And even down to old age, all my people shall prove my sovereign, eternal, unchangeable love. Matthew Henry says he was a father to the poor, not only a judge to protect them and to see that they were not wronged, but a father to provide for them and to see that they did not want, to counsel and direct them, to appear and act for them upon all occasions. This is so often what people long for, the days when they made a difference. But every saint still makes a difference when he or she prays, speaks a word about the Lord to someone, in season and out of season. We all have things we can do to continue to serve, and God will never leave us nor forsake us. This is what Job did not know at the time. This is what makes this chapter so very, very moving and heart-wrenching. He looks back to those days, and his verdict on it is, I had the blessing, and it's gone, and God's gone, and the Almighty is no longer shining his lamp upon my head. But that's not true. That's not true. Sometimes we have to simply hold on to the Word of God that he will never leave us nor forsake us. But as David Livingstone, the missionary, said, that is the word of a gentleman. That is the word of a gentleman. It is true. And it is important that we believe that and do not believe for one moment that those golden days when we were first converted was the high point of our Christian lives. The high point of your Christian life may very well be at those times, when you're walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Do not fear evil. Why? For thou art with me. Amen.